army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. Today, I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast. This is episode 068, The Military Drone Revolution, Make All Flesh Forfeit. Now, before we get started, of course, maybe a few moments of housekeeping and administrative stuff. I have been trying to, through the good works of Chris Williams and Podsworth, taking every episode in both Chasing Ghost and War Notes and running it through his magic box to make my audio quality that much better. When I first started this, doing this by Braille several years ago, I had to teach myself from the ground up, not being a cyber ninja, how to get everything sounding properly, because I don't want to listen to a podcast that has the audio quality of someone speaking out of the bottom of a trash can with the same kind of reverberations and nonsense that would make it unpleasant to listen to, especially as I have hearing problems after the almost quarter century that I spent in uniform in the Legions. So I've taken the effort with Chris Williams to make that better. Let me know, I'd like feedback, no pun intended, on what you think of all the episodes that I've run through his magic box and made better. Let me know. You will also note that the frequency with which I have been issuing these podcast episodes has not been up to snuff of what it usually was, especially with the advent of the results of the election last year, in which I quickly put together my War Notes podcast and made my Fixing Fight Club series as a call to action for the new administration in the Pentagon to do the right thing and right the ship and keep us from crashing into the shoals of bureaucratic incompetence and labyrinthine decision-making that has informed so much of American war-making since the end of the war to save Joseph Stalin in 1945. I'm involved offline in a number of pretty life-changing decision-making and changes that we are incorporating in our own lives in the Buebert clan, and I'm excited about those things, not to mention some of the work that I'm doing for the Libertarian Institute with the creation of the Scott Horton Academy, in which I am provisioning, providing, and creating some courses for that academy concerning military history, contemporaneous conflict, and conflict futurism. So that's on the horizon. I will make announcements as that stuff materializes. And with that, let's get on with this episode, The Military Drone Revolution, Make All Flesh Forfeit. Now, why do I say that? Those of you who are persistent and perennial listeners, thank you for being the folks that keep this podcast going and give me the strength to continue doing it and drawing from my memory palace all of these things that you're listening to right now. I happen to think in the title of this, Make All Flesh Forfeit, it may sound hyperbolic, but it's not. Because, as I've mentioned, for those who have listened before, I've said this before, for those for whom this is the first episode of my podcast that you've ever listened to, I have made the case that when it comes to revolutions and military affairs, which are those things like the development of the stirrup or smokeless powder or firearms that are fairly accurate because of rifled barreling and those kind of things. In all of the RMAs that we have witnessed from the 19th through the 21st century, I suspect in the 21st century, when the historians look back, if Earth survives beyond 2100 and doesn't find itself consumed in nuclear fire or whatever else may happen to humanity between now and then, they are going to look back, those military historians who haven't even been born yet, and they're going to take into consideration What caused what happened? How did military drones achieve what they did? And what were the implications for future conflict from 2025 until the middle of the 21st century? And as I mentioned, if we survive that long, till the end of the 21st century. And what does the national chessboard look like 5, 10, 15 years from now? So there was a recent report. One should always question the veracity of these reports because, as I've mentioned before, the Ukraine-Russian conflict is one of those conflicts, as a professional conflict observer all my adult life, in which I can't trust a lot of the data that I see, especially when it comes to the mainstream media, which I like to call the coprophile media, which fortunately is dying as we speak, because this humble little podcast, this long-form journalism, as it were, and I'm stretching the word journalism there, I know, as a podcaster, but nonetheless, we're the future of information. We're also the ones who are less subject to AI manipulation and perception because we have long-form communications with Socratic drilling and with vigorous cross-examination, a comprehensivist viewpoint of history, and what Mortimer Adler would call the syncretic or syntopical approach to the aggregation of knowledge by reading more than one book on a given subject. So in this case, I stand by my notions that drones, UAVs, FPVs, all of these variants of unmanned modalities that are airborne, and by the way, airborne is not going to be the sole modality by which these things operate in conflict and warfare, because you're going to find undersea UAVs, you're going to find surface UAVs, you're going to find unmanned ground combat vehicles, you will find unmanned combat aerial vehicles. All of these variations are in for a tremendous surge when it comes to what conflict is going to have to deal with from this part of the 21st century onward. I often like to do a chronological conceit experiment in which let's go back to 1990. Could anybody with their 1990 head, especially if they were paying attention to conflict, they remember that was the year before Desert Storm and the spectacular performance of U.S. and coalition arms against what was then touted as the fifth largest army on earth, the Iraqi army, which was routed in a matter of 96 hours. And then at the conclusion of Desert Storm in 1991, the world, especially the West, was ecstatic. It could be the end of history. It could be the end of war as we know it. It could be that kind of superiority, dominance, and supremacy of American arms that would ensure that the world was safe. Well, that's not the case, isn't it? Remember, this was the same era in the 1990s in which Bill Gates would say things like, the internet is simply a fad and that fax machines are the future. We would have folks say time and again that, well, it's going to be exoskeletons and the kind of robotic frames in which one could put a meat bag like a human being to give them the ability to run as bionic men, or what Starship Troopers would envision as the soldier and the infantryman in his combat exoskeleton, who would be able to perform all of these exquisite kinds of things. And then the turn of the 21st century comes, and then the internet takes over the world. The internet changes the way the world not only sees itself, manipulates information, divines information, arrives at conclusions, but it fundamentally changes the way wars are fought planet-wide. Fast forward to 2020, and we have the kerfuffle between Azerbaijan and Armenia, which in the fall of 2020 at Nagorno-Karabakh, on that tiny part of a map, on a relatively tiny part of the Eurasian Peninsula compared to the rest of the world, you have drones making their debut as a major player in a conflict between two competitors. Then the Russians invade the Ukraine, And then all of a sudden, we find that here we are almost 5 years into that conflict, and I'm seeing reports that say, and we can play with the figures, but I suspect the figures are relatively correct, 80% of all casualties, both KIA and wounded in action in the Ukraine, at Ukrainian hands or at Russian hands, are due to UAVs. We've all seen the mountain of video evidence that is out there of the atomistic use of first-person vehicle drones and UASs and drones to take out a single fighter, a single infantryman. It isn't confined to that, because we've also seen all of those videos where, I remember one that I saw recently, I think I mentioned it in another episode, where it appeared to be a Ukrainian infantry fighting vehicle. The FPV, you could tell that it was from its viewpoint because it was a little shaky camera, was waiting for the ramp to come down. Once the ramp came down and the squad minus was about to disembark from said vehicle, it went in there and exploded. Now, mind you, when you explode things within confined space, it causes even more visceral and morbid damage to human bodies, giving them the consistency of gummy bears, for instance, if you look at what artillery or tank munitions have done to humans who are confined to a small space. I happen to think that these reports are correct. I happen to think that the U.S. and the West, when it comes to affordable mass, which is, of course, the bureaucratic term that the United States would employ to describe their new suite of weapon systems that they would develop so that they could compete with these drones. And let's remember, when you look at affordable mass from the U.S. perspective and you look at some of the offerings and solicitations for the DoD to develop these from the ground up, you're looking at costs maybe $250,000. Sometimes they're flirting with $100,000. And this is in the face of both the Ukrainians and the Russians developing cardboard drones that are capable of the loft to bring grenade munitions aloft and point them in a given direction and direct them onto a given target for less than $3,000. Because as Joseph Stalin informed us, quantity has a quality all of its own, and that's what the Ukrainians have discovered, much to their chagrin. Now, in the past, you have heard me voice disgust and dismay at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, which is supposed to be the Area 51 and Skunk Works for developing extraordinary weapons, systems, effectors, sensors that would allow the U.S. to maintain its alleged supremacy and efficacy on the battlefield. I am a severe skeptic, as anybody who has listened to this podcast, especially from the first episode to this one. But I'm also skeptical of this organization called the RAND Corporation. The RAND Corporation was developed way back when, decades ago, to be a research organization that not only would pay attention to military matters, but other matters, but it spends a lot of time with its $500 million budget plus giving out these authoritative and bespoke research publications. I would urge you, if you get a chance, I'll put it in the show notes, to go to the RAND Corporation. They're really good about PDFs. They're really good about getting these kind of things electronically. So I would urge you, if you get the opportunity, to go there and explore and look around and see what they have to say. So I am skeptical of the conflict futurism in the DoD and the Pentagon and all of the proliferating defense intelligentsia Klingons that are around the Mordor on the Potomac defense industrial complex. So I thought, why don't I step back? I'll board my Wayback Machine here in the bunker, and I'll go back to 2015, and I'll examine what the RAND Corporation was saying about armed drones in 2015. And then I come across this page, and I'll put this in the show notes, and it reads, "Three myths about armed drones. Armed drone myth number one, they will transform how war is waged globally. Armed drone myth number two, it's counterproductive to develop international norms. Armed drone myth number three, global proliferation demands blanket restrictions on sales. Now, mind you, I look at all of these and I think to myself, okay, well, you can have all the armed proliferation treaties and all of those things in place that you want, but it doesn't mean that once two or more protagonist and antagonist start to cross that line into war and bloody conflict, that they're going to pay attention to that kind of thing. In the armed drone myth number one, they will transform how war is waged globally. One thing that it says is, even if interested in armed drones, it is not likely that terrorists would be able to develop more than a limited capacity to use them effectively. This is also true in terms of adapting armed drones to deliver WMD, since the challenges are magnified while the benefits relative to other means of delivery are questionable. It is noteworthy that outside Hezbollah, which is more a mini-army than a classic terrorist group, terrorists in general have not taken serious steps to acquire these systems. While unsuccessful in attacks against Israel, Hezbollah reportedly used drones to destroy Al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front targets along Lebanon's border with Syria. The benefits and limits of long-range armed drones suggest they offer their users significant capabilities but are only transformative in rare circumstances. All of this is so bloody wrong because we know that since 2015, that was only a decade ago, mind you, everything that I just read you is poppycock. Armed drone myth number two, it's counterproductive to develop international norms. Quote, an opportunity exists to replace potentially risky precedents in using long-range armed drones with international norms to decrease their misuse by others. A proactive approach to setting international norms could help the Obama administration, remember this was drafted in 2015, defuse domestic and international opposition to military operations where they are needed. The administration's new export policy for military unmanned aerial systems sets standards for exporting and using armed drones. The policy promises to work with other countries to adopt similar standards. Once again, it's the wish casting and dream framing, especially of that administration, which the following year would drop 26,000 bombs and precision-guided munitions on Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan during that time. Again, the wish casting. And then we have armed drone myth number three. Global proliferation demands blanket restrictions on sales. And it reads, I quote, and there are good reasons for potentially selling them to allies and partners to make these countries more effective in their fight against terrorist groups. In cases of any sale, the United States could make it a condition that the systems will be used only in accordance with the laws of war. The transfer of armed drones should be viewed in a similar way to U.S. sales of aircraft and whether they will contribute to or undermine regional stability. End of quote. Again, wish casting. I note that the transfer of armed drones should be viewed in a similar way to U.S. sales of aircraft. No one wants U.S. drone technology. What folks do want is they want one or several or teams or groups of members of the 35,000 strong drone racing league in the United States to come to them to help them develop their proper tactics, techniques, and procedures for employing drones in a more productive fashion. But again, this is the kind of hot garbage that is financed by the U.S. and the West for their extrapolations and formulations of what future conflict looks like. And I need to say this if I haven't said it explicitly before. One of the key jobs of having a conflict futurist cell in your organization, if you're in the defense community, whether it's the DOD or whatever the case may be. As a matter of fact, there just so happened to be a futures command in the U.S. Armed Forces that was a disaster for the most part because it was bureaucratically captured and would only say those things that wouldn't send the flag officers, whether admirals or generals, to the fainting couches because they were so busy fighting last year's wars. I would also draw your attention to a video, and I would ask you to look it up. As a matter of fact, I'll put it in the show notes. Slaughterbots is a 2017 arms control advocacy video presenting a dramatized near-future scenario where swarms of inexpensive micro-drones using artificial intelligence and facial recognition software to assassinate political opponents based on pre-programmed criteria would all of a sudden find themselves the preternatural threat against not only the political class, but we would also see it, if I recall, in one of the Marvel movies where all of a sudden the superheroes that were in the Marvels movie started to become or be attracted to evil in a fashion in which all of the resources that they had would be focused on eliminating through pre-crime data those people who potentially had the ability to do woeful and wrongful things to their fellow human beings. A sequel to that called Slaughterbots, If Human Kill, in 2021, that one presented additional hypothetical scenarios of attacks on civilians and again called on the UN to ban autonomous weapons that target people. I don't know how that could possibly be effective. And by the way, you're whistling past the graveyard because it is impossible to take drone technology today and park that back in Pandora's box and lock it up so that it could never be employed by a single combatant on planet Earth for the remainder of this century. That is impossible. So I've set the stage. This is much like those aspirants out there who say, well, we need to make nuclear weapons either prohibitively expensive or prohibit them altogether, because if we were to do that, then it would solve that problem. We could click our red ruby slippers and that problem would go away and nobody would ever have to fear nuclear weapons again. That is not how revolutions and military affairs work. And in this case, with drones, and if I have members of the audience who have the data to show me, let's say, as I did the exercise earlier, concerning extrapolation of second and third order effects or possible RMAs where they were writing about it between 1975 and the year 2000, some worthy in the defense intelligentsia who would have been able to extrapolate, and that way we would have the baselining capability at the time to develop these new weapon systems in anticipation. Now, mind you, other RMAs have occurred. It was December 7th, 1941, when the aircraft carrier fleet was spared at Pearl Harbor, but the battleship fleet, the darling of admirals for decades, if not generations, was destroyed there in Pearl Harbor. The very next day, the American air fleet in the Philippines was destroyed. During that time, two other capital warships owned by the British, the Prince of Wales and the Repulse, were destroyed exclusively by Japanese naval aviation. And they were done. It was done in a fashion in which no other ships were involved except for Japanese naval aviation. Churchill calls it one of the darkest periods of his time during World War II. So why do I make the claim that all flesh is forfeit on the battlefield? Well, it's the very same reason why I try to harp again and again that exquisite platforms like the aircraft carrier or the crossbow and chariot of the 21st century. And then we go to the other end of the scale in which one can't call an infantryman, one of my former vocations, an exquisite platform because, number one, they would object to the polysyllabic implications of the name-calling, as it were. But after all, remember that, as I've said before, infantrymen are homeless people with guns. But what we've discovered is that drones have completely changed the way that game is played. And one thing we have to keep in mind here is that in the 21st century, the peer fight, and it is a peer fight, not a near peer fight, especially because of Western and coalition forces providing arms, material, and training to the Ukrainians against the Russians, is we are having a grandstand, pedestrian, and audience seat to this conflagration, this armed conflagration over there. And what we're seeing time and again is that many things are changing. The A-10 and the Su-25 Frogfoot, which are close air support aviation assets, are now going the way of the dodo. As a matter of fact, if I recall, in 2026, the entire A-10 fleet, of which I am a big fan of, doesn't have any utility in peer conflicts in the 21st century. So the same thing applies here. We're removing all of these chess pieces. Well, those who are paying attention are removing the chess pieces. The U.S. certainly is not, because they play checkers. But in this case, at the other end of that spectrum of affordable mass, not only do we have those $3,000 UAVs, and we're seeing almost a Moore's Law imperative in the production of UAVs, where what were once exclusively first world electronic marvels are now being developed by third world countries, developing countries and such, whether they develop them in country organically or they purchase them from whoever their alliance countries happen to be, whether that would be the US, NATO, or BRICS. And they are discovering time and again that it works, because when it comes to atomistic firing, drones have a vote. When it comes to the infantrymen on the ground, drones have an even bigger vote. It's a vote as such that none of us, I suspect, maybe there are a few people out there who had the martial imagination to see it before any of us did. I don't think most of us professional conflict observers would have called the ball and said that, yay and verily, UAVs and drones are going to become the number one weapon to wipe out individual or small units of infantrymen on the ground. But that's what we're finding. And when it comes to the multi-spectrum detection of an infantryman, a carbon-based unit, a meat sack on the battlefield, humans have to do a variety of things to keep motoring. One of those is the exhalation of breath and inhalation thereof. We have a temperature at 98.6 degrees, given 2 or more degrees, depending on who you are as a human being. And when it comes to electronics, we have a ubiquitous tethering of all armed forces on Earth. Witness what just happened to the brilliant pager victims with that Israeli project, where they were able to weaponize pagers and make them explode on people who had used them as part of their everyday carry, to in addition to their phones, belts, and socks. It was a brilliant move, maybe one that won't be able to be repeated in the future. I always wonder, too, what would have happened if you had your pager in a Faraday bag where it couldn't receive the signal? Well, obviously, it would not have exploded. So my Moore's Law observation is that the cost of these is going to continue to go down dramatically. And that if that's the case, it is usually cost and price that limits who can have the most exquisite weapon systems. Right now, nuclear weapons, for the most part, are confined to those first world countries that can afford them. Right now, when you look at special operations forces, whether they're American special forces like the Green Berets and such in the U.S. Army, or the exquisite and incredibly well-trained and talented Ranger regiments, being probably the alpha predators when it comes to the craft of small unit infantry tactics, or you look at the special tactics squadrons in the U.S. Air Force and what they can do with ground combat. You look at Delta and CAG and what they can do in their very specialized milieu of kinetic engagement. Those are first world modalities. But guess what isn't a first world modality? Taking out a carrier. Because what we've seen, for instance, with munitions having a quantity all of their own, the carrier forces of the United States, for which they have the largest naval contingent of carriers on planet Earth have been chased out of the Red Sea. Now, but what we're talking about here is the other end of the spectrum. Now, whether you pay attention to the United Nations Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, which deals with chemical warfare and biological agents, and they're trying to extend that to drones, you can have all the ambition that you want that's rather cheap, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to make it happen. Extraordinarily, when we examine this, and let's take a look at something historically, which is a niche weapon system. That niche weapon system would be chemical and biological weapons. Chemical weapons like mustard gas in World War I, biological weapons, which would be the anthrax vaccines that were experimented with by Axis and Ally alike in World War II. The problem with those suites of weapon systems is that, with exception, they tend to be rather fratricidal, which means that when you expose those as offensive weapon systems, they tend to, for instance, with mustard gas or chemical gases of any type, if the wind shifts, then your own forces are going to suffer. Same thing applies unless you have exquisite and very targeted genetic coding for the reception of biological weapons, that those could be out of control. I think that American and Western cinema has relied on probably a good portion of its cinematic portrayals of the near future with what happens if a chemical, or more so a biological weapon, is lost control of by whatever laboratory is being experimented in by a first world nation to develop these niche and boutique weapons. What happens if they're released into the wild? Well, of course, we see those extrapolations tend to be it can wipe out entire populations, and I happen to agree with that. But there is no way to put drones and UAVs back in Pandora's box. The only thing that can be done now is prophylactics and defensive means against these are being experimented on nationwide and worldwide. For instance, can we develop shotgun shells that can take out the drones? Can we develop jamming mechanisms in which the drone frequencies that they are relying upon can be jammed in a sense where they will just either stop rotating, or in this case, rotating meaning the four corners or more of the quadcopters and such that seem to be very popular along with the winged modalities, whether jet, which is a minority, or propeller driven, especially for those that weigh less than 200 pounds. Look, the cat is out of the bag. There is no way to stop third world and developing countries from either acquiring this technology and advancing upon it organically, or getting it from whatever alliance structures or supporting financial structures are giving them the means to continue their conflicts, whether it is intrastate in a civil war or in a war with a contiguous nation state, or one that just happens to be a little bit farther away. So one can look at revolutions and military affairs, and you can ask yourself this simple question. Has this kind of technology instantiated itself in the past where it showed that there was an equilibration, a democratization, a leveling of the ability between not so wealthy countries or not wealthy countries at all to hold first world national militaries not only at bay, but to deter them and defer them in such a way that they are an existential threat to those first world nations that are exporting violence via military means into these countries. If one looks at the nearly quarter century that was spent in Iraq and Afghanistan, and in a smaller time frame, Libya, Syria, and Yemen by the West and their Western satraps in the Middle East, and then we would sort of shoehorn this technology prior to 2020, it would cause a tremendous amount of problems. I suspect that if right now in the year 2025, somehow in a new timeline in which 2001 and 9/11 never happened, and that all of a sudden Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, or any of those is attacked right now for some causus belli by the United States or coalition forces or Russia, would be subject to drone warfare that would tip the balance to that nation that was fighting the First World Military Invasion. I think things would look quite a bit different than they looked in 2001 and 2003 with the attacks in Afghanistan and Iraq, respectively, back then. So is the use of very cheap directed drone warfare, is it a revolution in military affairs? There is no doubt in my mind. Is it an existential threat to the exquisite platform-centric technological complex that is First World militaries? Absolutely. Does the U.S. and the West have the means to fight this? Well, they can certainly think they have the means to fight it. For instance, I would direct you to IEDs, and I would direct you to JAIDO, which was the Joint IED Defeat Modality in the Department of Defense during the conduct of those wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where they would spend tens, hundreds of millions of dollars on new technologies, regardless of tactics, techniques, and procedures changes that they could make that would short-circuit a lot of that money spending and find more effective ways to do it. But the enemy has a vote. The enemy has a feedback loop. The enemy pays attention to that feedback loop. In the armed forces, we have something called after-action reviews. And what an after-action review is that after a training event or a live fire event or a live fire war event with actual opponents and antagonists, one gets around the fire, you get the cigars out and maybe some expensive scotch or whiskey or bourbon, and you ask yourself in a hot wash AAR, okay, immediately in the last 24 to 48 hours, what could we have done better? What did we do wrong? And what do we have to fix in our standing operating procedure in order to fix the fight so that we fight better next time? More formal AARs with one of the few things that I really endorse that the Army has done, which is a Center for Army Lessons Learned. I will put that in the show notes. And what you discover again and again is that if you dusted off those AARs and paid attention, especially if those AARs were conducted in a disciplined fashion and submitted to call as they should have been, a savvy and enterprising archivist or historian can go back there and they can find all of the ex post facto green lights and red lights that would have given us a clue bat of what was coming. So I do wish that we would do that more often, but we don't. But look, the First World and the United States coalition and allied militaries aren't the only ones who do that. They may not be as formal a process of AARs, those after-action reviews, that occur in the primitive villages of Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya or whatever the Middle Eastern modality of irregular warfare is that is being practiced at the time, but they do this because they have to do it, because they have to adapt, because the feedback loop, especially for third world and developing world insurgencies and armies, whether you look at the sophistication of the Vietnamese after World War II or the lack of sophistication that you would find in some of the northern tribes in Afghanistan, they were all learning organizations that paid attention to weakness. Because for time immemorial, when the insurgent and the aboriginal or the indigenous fighters who are defending themselves against an externalized invasion that visits their land, they find again and again they cannot stand and fight against conventional militaries. What they have to do is conduct raids. They conduct ambushes. They fight until they can't fight any longer without taking an unnecessary risk and reducing their numbers significantly. And they fade away. Well, I think to a certain extent, that's what we're going to see here. Now, there have been electronic means by which the counter unmanned aerial systems concerns in the West have spent countless tens and hundreds of millions of dollars to electronically spoof, fumble, neutralize, or destroy UAVs. What has been the response? Well, the response, for one, has been literally hundreds, if not thousands, of kilometers of very thin fiber optic wire that is festooning and draping trees throughout the eastern third of the Ukraine, so that when these drones were aloft, instead of being electronically tethered in a Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, or unwired way to their operators, they would have these very thin fiber optic lines so that they could not be spoofed or neutralized on the electromagnetic spectrum. There may come a time, for instance, where the West will finally get its head out of its keister and figure out that UAVs, and I am convinced by this in my examination of the Russian strike fires reconnaissance complex, that one of the reasons by the Russians, and a little bit by extension the Ukrainians, because the Ukrainians were raised in a Soviet system and later a Russian system, why they are all so good at the employment of FPVs, UASs, UAVs, and drone warfare is because the Russians recognize, whether this is implicit or explicit, whether this is conscious or unconscious, that these UAV fires are simply another permutation on artillery fires. And artillery fires, unlike the West, which is air-centric, artillery fires have always been the center of gravity for Russian arms at the tactical, operational, and strategic level. And I think that they know intuitively in their bones that here they have yet again a munition, a loitering munition, that if combined into all their strike fires planning and coordination can be synchronized in a fashion where they achieve that metal on target in a certain period of time in an accurate fashion so that they can ameliorate the threat before them in both a hasty and a deliberate fashion. The distinction between those two is that hasty is where it's rather unplanned. Deliberate is where you have target registration points of what you're going to hit. Most likely they are going to be there because they just don't happen to be vehicles, or they happen to be vehicles that are on unimproved and primitive roads, which tend to travel universally below 30 kilometers an hour. Drones are also proving out that when it comes to the calculus of, again, I'm always banging the drum on exquisite platforms, and the fact that manned tanks, manned aircraft, aircraft carriers, surface navies by extension, and all of these things deserve stringent and unwavering examination in a very hostile way to determine just how efficacious they are. I would suggest to my audience that all the exquisite platforms that the U.S. employs, and the West, again, because they're allied to them and they tend to mimic what the United States does, are the crossbow and chariot of the 21st century. America boasts the finest, most exquisite, and most expensive paper tiger in the history of warfare, with a 20th century military complex that is employed now that is not fit for purpose for 21st century peer combat. We are experiencing, as a result of the Ukraine and Israel, a severe depletion in magazines and larders for missiles, for instance, even for dumb rounds for 105 and 155 millimeter artillery weapons and such. What we're experiencing is a refusal for the DoD and the U.S. military complex to, I don't know if it's exaggerated to say they take it seriously. I just think that bureaucracies tend to prioritize things in a way that is 10 years behind what the bleeding edge of present thinking and permutations are dictating on the battlefield, and they will build things that are entirely inappropriate to what the future portends they will be employed for in the battlefield of the future. The title of this episode is All Flesh or Our Forfeit. What I mean by that is that it is impossible right now on a peer conflict battlefield to guarantee the survivability of a single human being that is targeted by a force that has the ubiquitous access to a lot of drones, has access to a communications and synchronization network to target those meat sacks on the battlefield, and that atomistically, there is no such thing as an opportunity above ground for the infantrymen to be safe anymore. Now, I went into this in far more depth in episode 013 of War Notes entitled End of an Era, the Infantry Folds Its Colors. So if you're interested in an extended conversation about that, I get the hand receipts and details out in a far more, in a far larger explanatory framework than I want to do for this particular podcast episode. But I'd like to make it clear that there's been no other time, let's confine ourselves to U.S. military history, in which the infantryman at the retail level was not only available and subject to targeting, but where I would consider it an existential threat in these times on the peer battlefield to assume that the infantryman, no matter what size, it could be the fire team, the squad, the platoon, the company, or all the way up to the brigade and regimental and divisional echelonments, that they would not be subject to an extermination campaign, because that's what this turns into. Because if I can kill, as I mentioned earlier, $3,000 UAVs that are made of cardboard in the Ukraine, if I can kill an individual soldier for $3,000 and I've got sufficient assets to do so, most peer armies, and I would suggest to you if they are more limited in number because it is a neo-colonial counterinsurgency campaign, that insurgency is going to find a way to deliver that means so that they can take out infantry soldiers and foot soldiers in detail. So look, I've made my case, I think, that the threat is real, that drones may be the most significant revolution in military affairs in generations that the U.S. and the West faces, and that unless they really take this seriously and find a way to ameliorate this threat, which I don't see forthcoming on the horizon, the ability of America to project military power in a palpable fashion that doesn't cost much more blood and treasure than it has in the past, that may be a moot point. My suspicion is that the next time the United States and the West gets involved in a conflict, they are going to find that, let's suppose, if it's the usual conflict, that developing or third world country is going to have in its quiver a means to absolutely destroy or neutralize in detail any ground forces that find their way into that country. This concerns me greatly because when I look, for instance, at all the saber rattling that is going on now concerning Yemen, and for various reasons of which we don't have to go into right now, if one looks at Yemen, and I did cover this in another episode where I talked about just how bad that's going to be, episode 61, The Mountains of Madness, Military Defeat and Terrain, Part 1, and then I did also Part 2, which was episode 67, where I tackled this Yemen problem, for instance. In short, the one-third of Western Yemen that is where the Houthi headquarter themselves, as it were, is extraordinarily mountainous, and mountainous terrain is extraordinarily difficult to best, not only with infantry forces less the drone threat, but combine the drone threat, and I think that things would be significantly worse for the invading forces. So what is to be done? Remember that I'm not on the Christmas card list, nor the cocktail party circuit for the Aircraft Carrier Industrial Association, or the irregular warfare modalities that are peppered throughout the service academies and the DOD, including the massive irregular warfare consortium that they've developed. nor am I privy to the folks who are dictating in the office of the Secretary of Defense how these matters should be handled, because I am persona non grata there, because I am a COINTRA and not a COINDANISTA, because I don't subscribe to those who think that Western counterinsurgency has any efficacy whatsoever, and I happen to subscribe not only to that, but thinking that every time that America and the West does get involved in counterinsurgency efforts, for instance, and irregular warfare efforts by extension, that when that happens, things are much worse on the other end than they were before America began in the first place. So my first suggestion to those in the DOD who may be listening, or those who have access to folks who may be on the cocktail circuit, of course, is that if you don't get involved in these conflicts in the first place, you don't have these problems. If you pay attention to defending your own country instead of always looking for dragons to slay overseas, whether it's the Atlantic or the Pacific, you tend not to run into these problems and have to address them. But let's suppose that habitude of the last 150 years can't be struck, in that America and the West continues their neo-colonial rake stomping planet-wide. What's to be done with the drone threat? Number one, if you're not an emissions condition zero, which is the fact that if you were to have a human on the ground, this is especially a problem for ships at sea, especially combat surface ships. But if you are not at zero emissions as far as your radio frequencies and your electronic signatures and such, then you will be found out on the battlefield. Your flesh will be forfeit. And I suspect with the measures and signals intelligence apparatus and what they've been able to expand upon, that thermal signatures of human beings, virtual breathalyzer events that would take place on the ground to detect the breathing of human beings. Maybe they would find other ways to detect human presence. It wouldn't be hard when it comes to detecting human beings being there if you weren't to look on the electromagnetic spectrum to find other things that are habits of the habit-bound creatures that are human beings, where if one paid enough attention by just observing through intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, maybe you could find other ways of where they are. A consistent movement along a certain supply route, or consistent movements along supply routes that appear to be random at first, but over time, that randomness starts to disappear. So you could find ways to detect human beings that way. That is something that has to be tackled. The other thing that has to be tackled is AI has been democratized. AI, or artificial intelligence, has become incredibly cheap. Now, while it has its foibles and pitfalls as far as its use on the battlefield, there's no doubt whatsoever. What it does do is AI reduces the analytical timeline so that it doesn't take one as long, once trained properly, for that AI to really compress and reduce the amount of time it takes for that menu of decisions to display itself, so that those at the tactical, operational, and strategic level can do their targeting in a much more timely fashion. I'm going to start to read a book. I know I'm a geek. I'm rather excited about it. It's a book called Fighting by Minutes, Time, and the Art of War by Robert R. Leonhard. And what he basically says in here is that time is the primary dimension in war, and that to win, the warrior must fight by minutes. From his experience as an infantry officer and war planner, Leonhard lays out the important time dimensions of war fighting: duration, frequency, sequence, and opportunity. He shows how the great captains of history turned the enemy's time flanks, preempted defenses, or manipulated the frequency of operations to their advantage. I'm going to do an entire episode that will be a review and discussion of this rather arcane book, but I think it's so important right now to take these things into consideration, because one of the Manhattan projects for the future is, how do we take time compression modalities? How do we reduce or eliminate the human in the loop so that in this battle of reducing the amount of time for reaction in an effective and accurate, rational fashion in the War of Leakers, that is the salvo competition of missiles, for instance, that army, whether it's from the Third World or the First World, that sort of wickers together a solution to this wicked problem is the one that will prevail. Well, mind you, they will prevail in that first conflict. But as I've counseled you again and again, war and conflict is one of those feedback cycles, and those who are paying attention to what happened, whether defeat or victory, they are going to be far more prepared for the next conflict if, in a red teaming and contrarian fashion, they examine not only where they succeeded, but where they failed, and they address that in a fundamental fashion, which is something that the American DoD has proved itself practically incapable of. So how does one defeat drones? The answer isn't here yet. Can you shoot them out of the sky with shotguns? Possibly, but I think there's a lot mitigating against that, especially in a war of increased density where drone after drone after drone comes in, and those drones keep coming in until your kinetic magazine or larder is exhausted, and then they come in, land in your lap, and then you assume room temperature, or you are neutralized in a fashion in which you cannot go any further in your war-making capabilities. I think the sky is the limit. I don't know what the answer is in the future, but I would urge the DoD and all those military mandarins in our military-industrial complex, grab some people, some smart folks, set them aside, and give them the resources both quantitatively and qualitatively as far as models and simulations and looking at historical precedent and finding ways to tackle this wicked problem, because you may not want to pay attention to it, but it wants to pay attention to you. Now, that concludes this episode. I suspect I'm going to sleep on this or think on this, and I'm going to say, man, there should be a part two to this, because there's some things that I missed. That may very well be the case. We shall see. I would urge my readers to give me some feedback if you can on the audio quality. This episode will be run through Chris Williams' Magic Box at Podsworth before it's issued. And I'm hoping you guys are seeing a stark difference between this and my amateurish efforts before. I also want to call out and call to your attention that in Parameters, the United States Army War College Press publishes this quarterly. I've been a fan for the longest time, but I do not like what's happened. It appears in the last 5 to 6 years in which it's gotten incredibly woke and politically correct. But what hasn't? I mean, that's sort of saturated the entire professional military education complex. There was a book review by a former student of mine, Josh Van Buskirk, a book review of Provoked by Scott Horton, and Provoked: How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in the Ukraine. Here we have a rather favorable review that isn't a booster for either side, but tries to critically and dispassionately examine, and Scott Horton does a great job with this because he brings the footnotes and the receipts to prove his point. And I'm surprised to see this published, and I'm glad for it. So kudos to you, Josh. I'm so proud of what you've done by getting this in a mainstream military publication, and it is entertaining contrarian and not popular notions in the DoD itself. So I think this is a step forward. I'd like to thank all my listeners for your solicitude. I'd like to thank my paid subscribers for parting with your hard-earned dollars to support my efforts here at both Chasing Ghost and War Notes. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can reach me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. You can also look up my Chasing Ghost Substack. Both of these things will be in the show notes. And I always appreciate gentlemanly opinion and constructive feedback. If I've missed something or my evidence is insufficient. I am never shy to claim that I'm wrong if one of my high IQ worthies in the audience points that out. So with that, I wanted to thank you again, and this is Bill out.